Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Melvin Goodman, a former CIA analyst and author, who assesses the dangerous consequences of Israel's bombing of Iran's Syrian embassy and the Biden administration's response to the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. Katya Schwenk, a reporter with the Lever Investigative News site, who examines the case Snyder versus the United States coming before the U.S. Supreme Court that could weaken federal corruption laws. And Philip Hosang, of the media watch group Fair.org, who talks about how right-wing media are weaponizing disinformation on immigration issues to win votes in the 2024 presidential and congressional election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since the war began with Ukraine in 2022, Russia's Black Sea Navy has been hit hard by Ukrainian forces. The fleet, stationed in Crimea, has lost 15 naval vessels, including its flagship. Now, the Putin regime is talking about moving the Russian fleet to Abkhazia, the breakaway region in the nation of Georgia. Yet the port in Abkhazia on the Black Sea is undeveloped, and Moscow would need to build new port facilities. The pro-Moscow government in Abkhazia, which broke away from Georgia in the early 1990s, supports the plan. Several regional security analysts believe Russia is unlikely to move its entire naval fleet to the South Caucasus, but the move could put pressure on Georgia and other pro-NATO governments. Foreign Policy reports that the new base would be a staging area for Russia's navy in the Black Sea and would disrupt Georgia's plan to attract investment as a trade corridor between European and Asian energy markets bypassing Russia. Talk of a new Russia naval base in Abkhazia has raised political tensions and put pro-Western Georgia on the defensive. It could derail Georgia's ambitions to build its own deep-sea port on the Black Sea. For more than 20 years, Georgia has sought to become a member of the NATO alliance, though most officials concede privately that's a long way off, particularly as war rages in Ukraine. A recent report by the Housing Assistance Council, a nonprofit that supports affordable housing efforts throughout rural America, found that these rural regions are losing affordable housing at an alarming rate, fueling a growing housing crisis where the homeless are less visible. Barn Raising Media reports that 1.4 million homes in rural areas fail to meet basic standards with essential services like water, sanitation, and electricity. About a quarter of rural households pay more than 30% of their monthly income on housing costs, and less than half of rural residents own their houses outright. Over 50% of all vacant homes in rural America are seasonal or recreational homes. During the COVID pandemic, some rural communities saw their population surge with migration from cities, further aggravating the housing shortage. Many farm workers who don't have housing sleep in cars, and when employers do provide housing, conditions are usually poor. In Iowa, investor groups are buying up mobile home parks and hiking rents while ignoring basic maintenance. But some mobile home residents are fighting back by organizing to find new owners and make necessary improvements. Donald J. Trump's net worth on paper dramatically increased when his new social media venture, Trump Media and Technology Group, became a public company. In the process, Trump Media relied on $40 million in emergency loans, including a bridge loan from a family trust operated by Russian-American Anton Postolnikov, who runs an offshore bank linked to the porn industry. Postolnikov is the nephew of Alexander Smirnov, an ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Guardian reports that the proposed Trump Media merger with Digital World Acquisitions, a shell company, came under federal securities investigation in 2021. It forced Trump Media to burn through lots of cash and seek private financing. Trump Media then received $8 million in loans from the ES Family Trust, based in the Caribbean island of Dominica. The trust operated through Paxim Bank, controlled by Postelnikov, who is involved in 3 years of transactions with Trump Media. The trust loans were used to prop up Trump Media and its Truth Social platform until the company was cleared to go public. Federal prosecutors charged Postelnikov associate Michael Schwartzman with money laundering in March, in addition to charges last year of insider trading of Digital World shares. Schwartzman and his co-defendants pleaded not guilty. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As Israel's war in Gaza enters its seventh month, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, under growing pressure to end the mass slaughter of Palestinian civilians, ordered the bombing of Iran's embassy in Syria on April 1st that Iran said killed seven of its military advisors, including three senior commanders. While the airstrike may have momentarily distracted the world from Israel's widely condemned targeted killing of seven World Central Kitchen humanitarian aid staff in Gaza, the Israeli attack on a diplomatic compound in violation of international law could trigger a dangerous regional war. The war in Gaza, which began after the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack on Israel that killed 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 240 hostages, has now killed at least 33,000 Palestinians, two-thirds of whom are women and children. Many of the 2.3 million residents of Gaza now face starvation due to Israel's blocking of food, potable water, and other basic humanitarian aid. Although Israel recently permitted 300 aid trucks to enter Gaza, the highest number of trucks since the war began, the UN says these deliveries fall far short of the minimum required to feed millions of hungry, malnourished people. Your reporter spoke with Melvin Goodman, a former CIA analyst, now a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, and author. Here he assesses the dangerous consequences of Israel's bombing of Iran's Syrian embassy that could trigger a wider Middle East war, and the Biden administration's response to the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza.
Iran doesn't want war. They certainly don't want a war with Israel, and they don't want a war with an Israel that's backed up by the United States. And Biden has made it clear he's still going to back Israel with regard to Iran or Hezbollah, for that matter. Iran's strategy is simple, I think. It's to use these proxies, use these militia groups. And if they militia groups go too far, such as when they killed three American soldiers in Jordan, Iran told its militias to back down, to back off. And the signal to the United States I find very interesting because they reached out to us in January for secret talks that led finally to a United States response. It took much too long for the United States to respond, and they eventually set up indirect talks where you had an Iranian delegation in one part of a hotel and a U.S. delegation in another part of a hotel and messengers running back and forth. But the key to me is a dialogue between the United States and Iran. And I find Biden, I think, fearful that if he reaches out to Iran or even responds in a positive way to Iran's efforts to establish some dialogue, he'll look weak and his Republican opposition will take advantage of that. So the fact that there's an election coming up in a few months, I think, is a real problem for Biden and for the international situation. But when you look at Iran, they're to me, preoccupied with domestic issues. They have serious issues of mismanagement. They are dealing with the economic problems from the sanctions. There's terrible corruption in Iran. but they are developing a nuclear program, which they couldn't have developed under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action that Obama negotiated in 2015, that Trump came along and abrogated in 2018.
Well, Mel, we only have about a minute left, but after I heard about Israel's airstrike of Iran's Syrian embassy, it appeared to me that it was calculated to distract the world from the unfolding catastrophe in Gaza, the death of the humanitarian aid workers, the World Central Kitchen that were killed, and create a crisis that could deter President Biden from conditioning military aid to Israel, as has been called for by a growing number of people in the U.S. Senate. On the same day that Israel attacked the Iranian embassy in Damascus, a reporter asked the U.S. State Department, Kirby, why America is giving 2,000-pound bombs to Israel while it's destroying Gaza. And Kirby answered that Israel needs these bombs to confront Iran as well. And it just seemed to play right into what Netanyahu was doing with this launching of the airstrike on the Iranian embassy in Damascus, which potentially could take any kind of restriction of military aid to Israel off the table.
Well, you raise the issue that worries me, and that's our complicity. Our complicity with Israel over what's happening in Gaza and what's been happening for the past 6 months and the horrors of that military campaign. And then now the potential for further complicity with regard to what Israel may decide to do with regard to Iran. My concern is that Netanyahu needs this war. He needs this war politically to stay in power. He's saving his own political situation by continued warfare, because when the war ends, he'll be gone. But what I really worry about, even further than that, is would Netanyahu try to drag the United States into a greater regional war that involves Iran? Again, Iran clearly does not want war. They're in no position to deal with war. But the United States, in announcing in the middle of all of this disaster that's taking place, we're going to supply 1,800 more 2,000-pound bombs and 500 additional 500-pound bombs. Those bombs themselves are violations of international law because Israel has used them in domestic areas. They've used them against urban dwellings. They've used them against high-rise apartment buildings. When you look at all of the civilians who've been killed, the number you cited of 33,000, and then you look at pictures of what has happened in Khan Yunis, in Gaza City, and elsewhere in northern Gaza, it looks like the major battles from World War II, what Berlin looked like and Dresden looked like and Stalingrad looked like. So Biden has always convinced himself, unfortunately, that if we supplied Israel with all of its needs, they would not only be more conciliatory toward the Arabs because they feel safer and more protected, but they'd also be more willing to listen to the United States. Well, here we are in the wake of Biden's so-called ultimatum to Israel, that Netanyahu's already making clear that there will be a date set for the invasion of Rafah, with nothing being said about the 1.5 million civilians who are now huddled in Rafah in the worst possible conditions that are threatening famine for so many people.
That was Melvin Goodman, a former CIA analyst, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, and professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. Find a link to Goodman's recent articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A case will be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court on April 15th that court watchers fear could further legalize political bribery in the U.S., following other such cases that have been decided recently by the High Court. This case stems from the bribery conviction of a small-town Indiana mayor, James Snyder. An article on the Lever investigative news site observes that the Snyder case is particularly noteworthy because it concerns a landmark federal anti-corruption law, 18 U.S. Code 666, which outlaws fraud or bribery within entities that receive significant federal funding, like state governments or universities. The plaintiffs in the case, Snyder versus the United States, argue that the Supreme Court should significantly limit its interpretation of the law and rule that it shouldn't bar illegal gratuities or rewards given to an official as a thank you for a governmental action. Legally, they say, this is distinct from a bribe, which involves a prior agreement to exchange money before an action is taken. Snyder's lawyers claim the law should only criminalize explicit quid pro quo bribery, which is far more difficult to prove to a jury. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Katja Schwenk, the Lever reporter who covered the story. Here she describes what happened in the case and the possible wider implications of a Supreme Court ruling that could weaken federal corruption laws and legalize bribery.
The case revolves around this mayor in a small town who is prosecuted under, you know, a particular bribery statute. Prosecutors chose to use this one, which, you know, not only makes bribery illegal, sort of what people understand to be bribery, you know, you pay a politician in exchange for them doing something for you, usually secretly, or it's sort of understood to be kind of an illicit agreement. But this particular law that's at issue in this case also makes it illegal to, if a politician does something, to then pay them, like after the fact, to give them. In this case, the politician got $13,000 from a company he helped get contracts. He's appealed his conviction all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court with support from groups like the Washington Legal Foundation, groups that are, you know, backed by the Koch Network, by oil and gas companies, that sort of right-wing legal apparatus that we see a lot in these kinds of Supreme Court cases. So yeah, again, at a high level, and, you know, obviously it remains to be seen what the Supreme Court is going to do, but it seems like this case is really designed to weaken protections that we have against corruption at both a local and higher level. Mayor James Snyder of Portage, Indiana, he was charged by federal prosecutors a few years ago, I think in 2012 or 2013 originally. Briefly, what he had done was, and he had given a contract that was worth $1 million or more to a local garbage truck company. And there were allegations that he had rigged the bidding process to like make sure that the city gave the contract to this company. And after he did so, after the garbage truck dealers got this contract, they wrote the mayor a check for $13,000, which, you know, he claimed to be a consulting expense, but it wasn't clear that he had ever done work for the company at all. That was all sort of proven at trial. So, I mean, again, seems like a pretty straightforward, clear-cut case of corruption by a politician, something that I think most people agree that we don't want to see this happening, you know, whether it's in a small city in Indiana or, you know, on a federal level. But he, you know, managed to get the support in his case of this whole, as I said, right-wing legal apparatus that has brought similar kinds of cases to the Supreme Court, similar kinds of bribery or corruption cases that have limited the scope, that have weakened bribery laws, you know, over the last decade or so. You know, because of that support, they have worked this case up through the appellate courts to the Supreme Court. And now the Supreme Court will consider, you know, whether or not to weaken this key federal bribery statute. And, you know, experts say that it could have implications beyond just what this one law into various laws that deal with that kind of illegal gratuity.
So can you just talk a little bit more about the implications of this?
The implications, you know, it will depend on how the court rules, of course. Well, they could agree with the government and say, you know, we want this law to stand. People I spoke to were kind of unsure what they would do, but a lot of them, attorneys I spoke with, several said it's likely that the Supreme Court took it up in order to weaken the statute. So we'll have to see. But if they do decide to rule in favor of this mayor and do so in sort of a broad way, they could weaken all different kinds of bribery laws that deal with this kind of gratuity, which again is this $13,000 that the mayor got after he gave the contracts to the company. This specific kind of bribe that is given after an official, a politician, you know, a contractor does something that people agree is corrupt, which would essentially, you know, if you think about this really broadly, mean that, you know, it would effectively legalize corruption as long as you could say, well, we didn't agree to have this kind of payment scheme. It was just a, you know, sort of a tip or a payment that I gave after an official did something that I liked, which is, of course, a very easy to argument to make because it's not common for you to have evidence of a prior arrangement to give a bribe or money. And so experts worry that they could have these broad implications that would really weaken laws that prosecutors use to bring bribery charges.
That was Lever investigative reporter Katja Schwenk. Find a link to her story and more analysis of the Snyder versus U.S. Supreme Court case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For decades, the Republican Party has been engaged in a hateful campaign to demonize immigrants as a threat to America. With the large increase in the number of migrants requesting asylum status at the U.S. southern border, presumed GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump, Republican politicians, and their allied right-wing media outlets now falsely claim that the influx of immigrants constitutes a dangerous invasion that has set off a national crime wave. In fact, numerous studies find that immigrants to the U.S. are less likely to commit crimes than native-born American citizens. Yet Trump, Republicans in their media echo chamber, have effectively repeated this lie in order to instill fear among voters in the months before the 2024 presidential and congressional election. According to many polls, more Americans now name immigration as the most important problem facing the country. It's clear that Trump and others in his party use immigration as a not-so-subtle dog whistle to incite racial hatred, as he quotes Adolf Hitler to label migrants as subhuman vermin and animals, poisoning the blood of America. At an April 6 fundraising event, Trump's racist views were obvious when he complained about the lack of immigrants to the U.S. from, quote, nice countries like Denmark or Switzerland. Your reporter spoke with Philip Hosang, an intern at the media watch group Fair.org, and a master's student at New York University. Here he talks about his recent article titled Fox News Border Stats Distort Immigration Reality and the Political Weaponization of Disinformation Surrounding U.S. Immigration Issues.
So conservatives have kind of broadly been speaking, have used immigration kind of fear-mongering as a cudgel over the last, like, I think ever since I've been a kid, I've heard like the idea that our borders are about to be overrun because Democrat presidents aren't doing enough to stem the inflow of millions upon millions of migrants. And that's just kind of continued to be the narrative and get more and more extreme over time as time has gone on. And what kind of drew me to this was because I was kind of watching the general discourse and temperature about immigration because it was a major point of conversation. I think polls right now show that in a lot of states, that's the number one issue currently on the docket for people looking at considering their voting prospects. And when I was looking at the conversation, I noticed that a lot of it kind of sat in a lot of vague statements that were existing in spaces of, oh, this is how many illegal entries have existed, this is how many border contacts, this is how many people are illegally in the country. And like there was a lot of conflation between terms and ideas that kind of arose red flags in my mind. So I decided I'd just start to do a bit of a deep dive and try and figure out exactly what was going on and disentangle some of the numbers to get a better idea of exactly what the situation at the border really was.
Philip, you do a lot of excellent dissection and analysis of the numbers that are thrown around on the flagship of the Republican and Trump propaganda campaign. And we probably can't go into all the stats, but do a reality check for us. What are the numbers being thrown around on Fox and the other right-wing media networks? And what's the reality that you found in terms of the real numbers?
Most recently, a lot of people have been talking about this 7.3 million number. This number is in reference to the CBP border contact number that basically identifies how many times Border Patrol officers have come into contact with different people who are trying to cross the border, whether it be between ports of entry or at ports of entry. This is a very like misleading number because when people see the 7.3 number, one, they identify it as each one of these 7.3 million contacts are unique individuals. But when in reality, a lot of these people are people who were turned away previously, especially under Title 42, and then later once again came back to attempt to enter the country again. And then two, that like a lot of these numbers break in into way more specific categories of thing. For instance, when we look at the border contact number overall, that 7.3 number actually breaks more broadly into three categories, those being Title 42 expulsions and Title 8 apprehensions and inadmissibles. Inadmissibles being people who go to the border, who try and enter at a port of entry and are turned away or identified as not being admissible into the country. Apprehensions being individuals who do attempt to cross between border crossings, but they're caught by a border patrol. And then Title 42 being people who, especially during the pandemic, or specifically during the pandemic, were turned back without being allowed to put forward an asylum application underneath medical considerations because we were in the pandemic and we were looking for to avoid COVID and flying into the country.
Well, thank you, Philip. And I did want to ask you a bit about the great replacement theory, and you mentioned it in your article. For a long time now, Republicans and Donald Trump have cited the great replacement theory that Democrats are somehow have a nefarious plan to replace American workers and American voters with a flood of immigrants into this country. Tell us a bit about how that fits in with the kind of information or disinformation, I should say, that's coming out of Fox News, OAN, Newsmax, and all the affiliated right-wing propaganda outlets.
I think a major issue that you start to see when it comes to conversations around immigration or a lot of political conversations in general, especially in the age of very strong kind of polarization, is that you start to see narratives come about that are constellations of more fundamental ideas that are appearing here. So for immigration, it isn't just that there's an influx of immigrants. Instead, it's an influx of immigrants that is of historic scales that are all coming into the country without any pushback, who are able to stay in the country. That's all being done at the behest of Democrats, who are seeing them as their golden goose towards having a permanent majority voter base in the country. And when you have all these individual pieces that kind of fit together into this constellation in order to sell that narrative, it makes it that any individual piece becomes unassailable because they're all relying on each other to sell that narrative.
That was Philip Hosang of the media watch group Fair.org. Find a link to his recent article titled "Fox News Border Stats Distort Immigration Reality" and related analysis and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KMUD in Garberville, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.